Erev Tov, good evening to all of you. And first of all, Baruch Haba to the last lecture in the series called Judaism in Crisis. And we are very honored tonight to have our educational director, Rabbi Nataf, speaking for us. I should mention that, and I may have mentioned this before several lectures ago, that the amount of people sitting in a classroom, or for that reason sitting in an auditorium, has absolutely no relationship to the topic which is being discussed. Perhaps it is even the reverse of what we think. We know that the most famous people who later really made it, people like Einstein, people like Freud, they used to have very small classes. I remember clearly that Freud started his series on psychoanalysis in Vienna many years ago, and I was told, or better, I read about this, that there were five elderly ladies sitting in the classroom, and these were the ones who heard these lectures. Later, 60, 70 years later, perhaps even later than that, people start to regret that they were not there and they didn't hear the master. Well, it has a lot to do with what Spinoza once said, also I do not remember exactly the phrase, but it is definitely true that truth is and perhaps can only be appreciated by the few. So you are the few, and we are very, very thankful for you being here tonight. Speaking about truths, there is a very famous midrash, and I'm sure you've all heard about it, which runs like this. When God was about to create Adam HaRishon, the first man, the malachim, the ministering angels, were split in contending groups how to advise God if he should or he should not create man. Some said, says the Midrash, let him be created. Let's create man. Others said, let him not be created. Mercy, Rachmanut said, let him be created, for he will do merciful deeds. True said, let him not be created, because he will live in falsehood, in Sheker. After God heard both sides of the story, the beautiful Midrash continues and says that God, Hashem, took the emet, he took the truth, and he casted it to the ground. As it says in Tehillim, emet, truth, will sprout from the earth. This is a very interesting, intriguing midrash. Because if you start to think about it, this parable, if we may call it by that name, this mashal, should actually haunt us. What are we being told over here? Is truth buried in the ground? Is it not revealed to us? Can we not relate to it? Is there no possibility to know the truth? Is truth imprisoned? In jail, very far removed from us. And indeed, will it only be possible for truth to prevail when man is not there? These are essential questions to human existence. The Kotzke Rebbe, who was known to be a man totally devoted to the truth and was not prepared to make any compromise, once tried to teach his students what truth is all about. And you may know there is a big machloket, a big difference of opinion between our different sages. Evil on one side, together with Sheker, with an untruth. What is the source? What is the root of it? How do they come into existence? So the Rambam in the Morei Nevuchim has a very debated response to that. And he basically says that it is the absence of truth which creates untruth. It is not a creation in itself. It's not that Hashem created untruth. But the moment that truth is not there, you're left with untruth. It is negation by which it comes about. That was the Rambam's observation, very much discussed and very much debated by later Jewish philosophers. The Baal Shem Tov took a different stand. He said like this, evil is the temporary manifestation of as yet hidden good. It is really good, but it has not manifested itself in any way, and therefore it looks to us as if it is ra, as if it is evil. But really it does not exist either. It is just looking to the truth from a wrong perspective. But the Kotzke Rebbe was not prepared to go along with that. He, as he usually did, made some very radical observations. And here is another one concerning truth. He said, no, there's a pasuk in the Torah which says like this. Zot chukat ha'asham. This is the law of the guilt offering. It is most holy, continues the Torah. Says the Scots Rebbe on that, where is the guilt to be found? Speaking about the pasuk saying, this is the law of the guilt offering. Where is the guilt offering, or where is the guilt of man being found? And he answered, in the holy. He used the pasuk and turned it around and said, the worst kind of a lie may be found right in the dominion of that what is holy. Because the moment that something is holy and it gets touched by an untruth, it becomes very difficult to know when it really is untruth and when it is indeed the manifestation of what is holy. So the question which we need to ask ourselves is this. If indeed, as the Kotzke Rebbe was of the opinion, it is possible that truth can be contaminated by a kind of holiness, if a lie can be understood within the framework of that what is holy, how then will we be able ever to discover when it is authentic truth? And when it is indeed not the manifestation of an untruth. But there is an answer to that, I think, on the end of our Midrash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu indeed throws the truth to the ground. It may be buried there, but it also says over there in the same Pasuk that it will indeed grow from the ground. Somehow man will unearth it. Somewhere man will know the way how to get it back in order again. It may be hidden for him. It may take a lot of toil, a lot of labor. It may be a matter of digging deep into the ground. It may be a matter of removing heavy stones. But somewhere man is able to find it. But indeed, it is very hard to do so. Well, my friends, in the last year, the Orthodox community has been challenged by the problem of truth. You may know, you may not know, but several books in the last year written by Orthodox thinkers of prestigious background, some of their books indeed were rejected by the Orthodox establishment. It happened all this year. Two or perhaps even three books like that. They were asked or to change the text of the book. One of them did. Another one decided or was forced to remove the book altogether from the bookshop. And it was done away with, more or less. And a third one, well, somewhere in the middle wrote, the book is still there, but everybody is told not to read it. This is most problematic. Very painful, I would say. People, for all sorts of reasons, which has little to do with the truth, were asked and forced by others, by an Orthodox religious establishment, to do away what they believed is the truth. This, indeed, is then told to be done l'shem shamayim, in the sake of heaven. But it is obviously very questionable if this is at all possible to be done in the sake of heaven. It may quite well be that indeed we are involved here in some kind of a lie covered with holiness, while in fact the holiness will not be able to reflect itself properly in the way as it should. We had invited, you do not know about it, two of these authors to come and speak for us in this series. One changed the topic. He didn't dare to speak anymore about it. But at least he came and spoke about another topic. You will hear later more about this. The other one dropped out altogether because he got so scared of the surroundings in which he lived that he felt that he better should be quiet. Most painful, most disturbing, and obviously little to do with the truths about which the Jewish tradition actually speaks. Perhaps it was a violation, and in many ways perhaps a chilul Hashem, in many ways a way by which God's name was compromised. It is for that reason that I asked Rabbi Nataf to speak about this very important topic, the question of truth. Rabbi Nataf, as many of you know, is involved in education already for many, many years. He's an educational thinker of great importance, in my opinion. He has published many different papers. He received semicha from Yeshiva University in America, has taught and headed several schools, and above all, and that's the reason why he's my good friend, he's a real mensch. A real mensch is perhaps the most important item, midah, to stay with the truth under all conditions. So I'm very, very proud, especially proud tonight to have him speak about this very important topic, and I call on to him to tell us what this truth is really all about. Mavakasha.
I want to thank Rabbi Cardozo, my dear friend and colleague, for his overly kind words. In fact, in the middle of the last few things he was saying, I thought that maybe he was speaking about someone else, that he had changed the speaker without telling me. When I look at the audience, I'm reminded of another story, an apocryphal story, and I feel like the main character in the story is told about Rav Amital, the then head of Meimad, that he met an individual in the street who came to him and said, "You must be Rav Amital." I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "I just wanted to let you know that I voted for Meimad." So he said, "Oh, so you are the one." I feel in a similar situation this evening. When one Rosh Yeshiva that I know looked at the title of my talk, he asked me what I was planning to speak about. And my actual response to him, believe it or not, was, doesn't the subtitle, Libertarian Implications of Contemporary Realia, doesn't that give it all away? What he was too polite to tell me, and what I didn't realize at the time, was that it was not the case. And that most people, in fact, have no idea what reality is and wouldn't know a libertarian if they were staring at them in the face. I realized this issue when no less a standard of English language and style than the Jerusalem Post called us several times to ask us whether the word that we were looking for wasn't really realism or reality. In fact, one copy editor decided that we were certainly wrong and changed the ad, and it almost came out to say Libertarian Implications of Contemporary Realism. Now, I'm not sure what that would mean, but I guess you can ask the editor. In fact, many people do not know what the word realia is, and taking my cue from the Jerusalem Post, I decided to look it up. I had to go through four dictionaries before finding an appropriate definition. And this is not a dictionary commercial, but you should check out Macmillan. They have good definitions. They define realia as real things, as the objects associated with everyday life in culture, in a culture, as distinguished from theories based on such things. Real things. Objects associated with everyday life. Chairs, machinery, cultural norms, and the like. Luckily, most people do know what contemporary means. And therefore, you probably figured out, even if you didn't know what realia means, that I was going to say something that had to do with something contemporary, something current, which I called realia, that's going to have some sort of impact on religious censorship. Now, those of you who worked very hard at deciphering the title even thought about libertarian being related to the word liberty, and may have even figured out that the implications of said realia was in the direction of liberty and thus away from censorship. If you did that, then you deserve a couple of brownie points. Before I explain my thesis, I want to start with a kvetch. It doesn't have to do with tonight's attendance. It's another kvetch. And I figure if you can't kvetch in a series called Crisis in Judaism, then when can you kvetch? In any case, my kvetch is the following. There are very few people who think about what they believe, and even less who make sure that the beliefs they think they have are actually held by themselves. We say a lot of things, and we think we believe a lot of things, but very few of us really analyze that which we're saying and that which we propose to believe. If I accomplish nothing else this evening, I would like people to realize that they don't believe two things that they commonly believe that they do believe. Number one, I want people to realize that they don't believe that all censorship is bad. Number two, I want people to also realize that halakha does change. We hear the phrase all the time in Orthodox circles, halakha doesn't change. If we think about it, there are very few, if any, Orthodox Jews that believe that. Allow me to explain the former. Namely, that censorship can be good. In fact, there are very few proponents of complete freedom of information, and there's good reason for that. To take the most obvious illustration, I do not know of a single government on the face of the earth that does not impose something called military censorship in times of war. Were a government to divulge its troop locations, distributions, not to mention its plans and strategies, it would certainly be putting most of its men on the field in great danger, not to mention possibly risking the entire war effort. Lack of censorship in that realm would be an inexcusable misuse of leadership. In that example, the major reason that information is being suppressed is so that it will not fall into the hands of an adversary who will use it against that nation. A more far-reaching and more common rationale for censorship is actually to protect one's own people. And I'll give you an example from the field of war there as well. During World War II, so I've been told, the United States would not allow movies that portray negative depictions of the war, gory or in any other way, in the United States, so as not to damage national morale. Here, the U.S. government was controlling information that would impact negatively upon their own nation. In halakha, we have similar situations. For example, one may not inform a sick person of the death of a relative, lest it aggravate that person's mental or physical state. I think that most of us will agree that censorship in those examples is proper and, in fact, desirable. I will not address tonight who should be making the decisions of what to censor and what criteria should be used for such censorship, as that is not the focus of my talk this evening. That being said, however, it should be clear that only an extremist will posit that censorship is never in order. Such extreme pursuit of individual rights is known as libertarianism. As far as the notion that halakha does not change, in a polemical effort to create clear lines between orthodoxy and other groups, we've created an intellectual Frankenstein. Anyone with serious background in halakha will know quite clearly that Judaism practiced today is quite different than the Judaism that was practiced 3,000 years ago, and to a lesser extent, even 300 years ago. While Orthodoxy does maintain that we are extremely limited in new legislation since the close of the Talmud and even before, this does not make halakha static, any more so than any other living code of law. As with any other code, new situations arise. And as with any code, it must deal with a whole variety of technical, social, and other historical changes that are the lot of mankind. In other words, while we may not add even rabbinic law, we will continue to adapt and interpret the laws as new situations arise. To bring a parallel from the American system, we have no legislative branch in Judaism, but we have a very active judicial branch that serves not only to educate, but also to interpret the laws. To give another illustration from the non-Jewish world, I don't know how many people are old enough in the audience to remember right and left hand turn signals. Some people. If you go back in automotive history, before the perfection of signal lights on the back of one's car, one had to stick one's hand out of the window to indicate if one was making a left turn this way or a right turn this way, if I'm not mistaken. Once the reality had changed and such lights were perfected, what sense would it make for us to stick our hands out of the window? In this case, we've referred to signal lights in cars as realia that has created a need for the change in law. The halakha has similarly to change corresponding to changing realia. And that fact should be obvious. Nonetheless, the fact that it should be obvious does not take away the need to illustrate the point. I will only choose a few examples, but you should realize that the halakha is full of such situations. In fact, any student here who has gone through any serious amount of Talmud and halachic text will immediately recognize the word ha'idna. Ha'idna means nowadays. Nowadays, meaning at some point, the halacha changed as a result of changing realia. In order to explain the first example, I want to know, by a show of hands, How many people here have fulfilled the Torah commandment of writing or purchasing your own Sefer Torah? How many people have done it? One person has done it. Two, three people. Okay? There's a discussion whether women have to do it, so that takes care of half of you, but certainly the men are not taking care of business here. In fact, the truth is, I would imagine that everyone, whether you know it or not, has fulfilled this mitzvah. Let me explain. Latter authorities give the stamp of approval of a certain interpretation attributed to the Rush and to the Geonim, and subsequently brought down in Shulchan Aruch. The position is that while in the Talmud you will find a precept to write your own Sefer Torah, the rationale behind such a mitzvah was in order to facilitate individual Torah study, to allow one to study from that Sefer Torah. Acquisition of a Sefer Torah was simply a means to an end, thus only relevant as long as it accomplished that end. Once people started studying exclusively from other books, such as Chumashim, Gemaras, and the like, the means, the mitzvah, metamorphosized into writing or purchasing those very books. And so therefore, if you've bought a Chumash at home, then you fulfilled the mitzvah according to the Rush, and according to at least one approach in the Shulchan Aruch. And while this position expectedly caused some commotion because of its radical reformulation of the mitzvah, and one should see the Maharal in this respect, is a position that, as you can see from tonight's show of hands, has been accepted by Klal Yisrael. Otherwise, there would be no excuse. Not only has it been accepted by Klal Yisrael, but this position has a prominent role in the Achronim. And while there's a discussion of whether one should ideally also purchase an actual Sefer Torah, most opinions agree that one can certainly fulfill one's mitzvah according to this approach. To give a more recent example, something perhaps more famous for those of you who like Haagen-Dazs, more close to home, and that's the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein in terms of consuming non-Jewish milk. Milk processed by non-Jews in countries that have government inspection. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, the law that one finds in the Gemara that one cannot partake of milk processed by non-Jew no longer applies in these countries. Because we have government inspection that take care of the fear that the milk may be tampered with and contain milk that is actually not kosher. Since we live in such states where this is no longer a problem, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, as far as the halacha is concerned, one may drink such milk without any problem. One wants to be machmir, that's fine. But in terms of the halacha, in spite of the fact that Gemara says you can't, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, that is a law that is no longer applicable in these countries because of the technical realia. Now, more interesting than the examples that I gave, which are based on technical realia, are various halachot that are based on changes in social realia. And I will give a couple examples of those as well. An interesting example is a Mishnah in Brachot that tells us that a chatan, a new groom, does not have to say Kriyat Shema, is exempted from the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. The rationale being, they will be preoccupied with other things. Now, while that's clear-cut, and there's no discussion within the Talmud, the commentary called Tosafot, changes the law completely and says that this exemption of the bra, of the groom rather, no longer applies, and bases it upon the following. Says that nowadays, meaning even in his time, the standard level of concentration of kavanah has reached such low proportions that it makes no difference whether you're preoccupied or not preoccupied. In either case, you're not going to have kavanah. So therefore, you may as well say Kriyat Shema. There's no relevant difference, says Tosfot, between a groom and anyone else. Again, we're not saying the groom is not preoccupied. We're saying that everyone else is also preoccupied with all sorts of other issues that are not having anything to do with being newly married. This halacha is in fact brought down in a very unusual way. The Shulchan Aruch starts with the pristine halacha of the Talmud, saying that in fact a chatan, a groom, is exempted. And then the Shulchan Aruch continues with the following words and says, Vehani mili bizman harishonim. אבל עכשיו שגם שאר בני אדם אינם מכוונים כראוי, גם הכונס את הבתולה קורה. Says the Shulchan Aruch, quoting Rav Meir of Rottenberg, that was true only in earlier times. But today, עכשיו, when no one can concentrate, then a groom must also say the Kriyat Shema. The focus, obviously, is on the word עכשיו. Recognizing the fact that the dispensation not say Kriyat Shema was based on a historical assumption that no longer existed, various Rishonim, followed by the Shulchan Aruch, decided that the exemption was no longer applicable. In more recent times, we have Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the Minchat Shlomo, first volume, tucked away at the end, an interesting little tshuva explaining a law probably most people are not even familiar with, the issue of a man walking behind a woman. Now, in Shulchan Aruch and Evan Ezer, there's discussion of various precautions that men should take so as not to stare at women. And among those precautions is that a man should not walk behind a woman. That's the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach suggests that this halacha is based on certain societal assumptions that existed in the time of the Talmud, namely, that there were very few women walking around. And also, that a man would be embarrassed to stare at a woman in front of her face. This is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Neither of these conditions exist nowadays, namely, that there are many women around. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if you pass one up, you'll find yourself behind another. You won't have accomplished anything. Secondly, he says that people who stare at women do it whether they're looking at them or they're not looking at them, so there's really no difference between walking in front, walking behind. And he concludes that a man is allowed to walk behind a woman, I'm sure you're all relieved, for the sake of a mitzvah, or, in typical Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach fashion, in order to be polite. That's what he says. Now on to the issue at hand. I will focus on one specific type of censorship, and I will use it as a paradigm for censorship as a whole. I will focus on a concept that Chazal, that our sages called halacha, ve'ein morin ken. Fascinating idea. Halacha ve'ein morin ken means that it is a law that should not be taught. Interesting idea. A law that should not be taught. What they meant was that the ancillary damage caused by likely popular misapplication of such a law outweighed the benefits of knowing it. In other words, these are halachot that were kept away from the masses for their own good. By far the most famous example is identified with the story of Pinchas. Even though over there it's not exactly the same phrase, but rather, Habali Malech Ein Morin Lo, essentially the same concept. The halacha over there that Pinchas applied is Haboel Aramit Knaim Pogeim Bo. Now, since this is a secret halacha, I'm not going to explain it to you. Rather, to illustrate my point, I'm really not. Rather, to illustrate my point, as you shall see, anyone who doesn't know the halacha may want to ask their neighbor to see if they know the halacha and can tell them. Now, while you're asking your neighbor, I'll interject a cute story that this reminds me of. There's a rabbi that just took on a new job and a new community. And everybody's looking forward to hearing the rabbi speak on Saturday morning. Comes up to the pulpit. And he starts with a question. You know, rabbis like questions. So he asks them, how many people have read this week's parsha? Now, since it's their new rabbi, even those who hadn't felt embarrassed, so basically everyone in the entire congregation raises their hand. The rabbi looks around in wonderment. What a congregation. So since everyone knows it, then I don't really have to talk about it. He turns around and sits in his chair. The following week, the rabbi asked the same question. Not wanting a repeat performance, when the rabbi asked the question, how many people have read this week's parsha? Everybody keeps their hands down. This time the rabbi has a look of outrage on his face. No one prepared the parsha. How can I teach it? Turns around and sits down. The next week the congregation decides that they're going to prepare for the rabbi. They're going to make sure to get a drasha that week. So they organize, the president and the board organize everyone. Anyone with a name from A to L is going to raise their hands. Anybody from M to Z will keep their hands down. And sure enough, the rabbi gets up and he asks his famous question. The congregants are quite pleased with themselves. They're going to get the rabbi this week. And he says, how many people have read this week's parsha? And in fact, half the people raise their hands and the other half don't raise their hands. The rabbi says, wonderful. Now, will the ones that learned it please explain it to the ones that didn't? Turns around and sits down. The fact is that many, and perhaps most of you, already know the halacha of Boel Aramit. And those of you who didn't or don't, and have not yet had an opportunity to ask your neighbor, because you're listening to the joke, we'll have the opportunity later this evening. You may consult books that you have at home, consult with more knowledgeable friends and acquaintances. And if all else fails, where do you go? Sorry? Art Scroll. No? Okay, well, I guess you're not as technologically oriented as I thought. Oh, there we go. The internet. The all-powerful internet. You know, when I think about the internet, I'm reminded of the refrain to Alice's Restaurant. I don't know how many of you remember that song, but the refrain, I won't sing it. you can sing it. Anyways, the refrain is, you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. And today it's not Alice's Restaurant, but rather the internet and the same murky connotations that existed with Alice's Restaurant also exist with the internet, as probably no one here knows. In any case, the irony of halacha The Ein Morin Ken in our times rose a couple of years ago when I was teaching a more prosaic example of this situation of Halacha Ve'Ein Morin Ken, which appears in Masechet Beitza. And I won't tell you where it is, because it's also a secret. Over there, the discussion has to do with sharpening knives in an unusual way, what we call a shinoi, on Yom Tov. And at the time, I was teaching a public shiur, which met twice a week, covering the entire tractate from the beginning to the end. And this was being taught to what one would consider the general public. As such, I had the wrong group with the wrong text. And there we were, on the beginning of Daf Chaf Chet, top of the page in black and white, Halacha Ve'in Morin Ken, and all my students saw it. Cat was out of the bag. And if these same students, who I was forced into at least teaching the text to, as otherwise they would have gone to the internet, now realized that there was a secret. Had they come back to me later on and asked me the halacha, I would be in a very difficult position if I were to try to hide it from them. What I would suggest, however, is that the cat was out of the bag long before my students saw it on Daf Chaf Chet in Masechet Beitza. I will suggest that certain historical changes in realia, have made the notion of Halacha Ve'en Morin Ken no longer applicable. There are three significant changes that have made keeping such secrets untenable. The first change is the writing down of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law, which is later compounded by the advent of the printing press. When the halacha was only taught orally, one could easily choose to whom to teach something and to whom not to teach something. The student was entirely dependent upon the teacher for the information. And as all you spy book fans can attest, no good spy commits a secret to writing. All the more so if these writings are going to be available to everyone, like the Talmud. This by itself, however, is not enough to change the notion of halacha ve'ein morin ken. And in fact, the Rishonim bring it down as it is in the Talmud. You can see it in the Shulchan Aruch, you can see it in the Rambam. They bring it down in these terms, that this is the halacha, but you should not teach it. The second change has to do with recent educational trends, if you want to call them democratic educational trends, that encourage the Jewish masses to study sophisticated texts of Talmud and Halacha. Historically, most Jewish societies, students like the ones that came to my shiur, would have been shopkeepers, woodcutters, even doctors, but would have been very removed from Talmudic study. Therefore, while they may have gone into a library, a Beit Midrash, a Beit Knesset, and taken out a Masechet Beitza and opened up to Daf Chaf Chet, the likelihood that they would have wanted to do such a thing would be very unlikely indeed. In our own times, Talmud is being studied by wider and wider sections of the Jewish people. I would say that this issue by itself may in fact have dealt an irreparable blow to the concept of Halacha Ve'en Morin Ken. There is a third change, and one who I've already alluded to, and that is the advent of the internet. So that now, someone who does not even sit in on a Talmud shiur or have interest in Talmud can simply pick up a concept, look it up, do a search, and presto, you have the halacha. In other words, any information that exists in the public domain becomes more and more difficult to conceal. Thus, censorship of anything but the most highly guarded secrets becomes highly impractical. I'm not saying the Chazal erred in wanting to keep certain halachot secret. In fact, one of our religious credos is faith in the best judgment of Chazal, of the rabbis of the Talmudic period and before. And as we pointed out earlier, there are times when censorship is the best policy. I'm simply saying, as in the previous examples, that the underlying realia upon which Chazal based the idea of halacha ve'ein morin ken are no longer present with us. And so, if like the Rosh Yeshiva, you didn't immediately figure out my thesis based on the subtitle, it should be clearer to you now. The realia that we're speaking about are both technological, specifically mass access to almost unlimited amounts of information, as well as social, greater educational exposure of Jewish laymen to sophisticated texts. The implications of these realia are that censorship of information will no longer be effective, or even maintaining old censorship may be as relevant as the old hand signals. Notice I'm not taking an intrinsically libertarian position. Rather, I'm suggesting that we align ourselves with a libertarian position only in response to various realia that make censorship no longer practical. And the application obviously goes beyond the specific example of halacha ve'en morin ken. To draw a more actual example, one of the things that Rabbi Cordoza alluded to in his introduction, if one intends to whitewash the biography of a certain scholar, of a rabbinic scholar we're speaking about, or of a certain yeshiva, the only way to do that is to somehow destroy all truthful information that exists about said scholar or said yeshiva. If you don't destroy this information, then you run the very likely risk of being caught in the act of distorting the truth. You will go from the impractical to the counterproductive. Incidentally, I don't think I'm the only one using halacha ve'en morin ken as a paradigm. It's a frequent thing to find in Ashkenazi poskim of the last several decades, places where they hide halacha out of fear that people will misunderstand them and go beyond what is actually permissible. I recall as just one example teaching the book Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata a couple years ago and noticing that while the body of the text said asur, that something was forbidden, careful reading of the footnotes actually said mutar, that was permissible. Going back to our paradigm, we are left with halachot that really can be misunderstood, and misunderstood to our detriment. If we no longer can repress knowledge of such halachot, we must do our best to make sure that they are not misunderstood. This, of course, leads me to my favorite subject, Jewish education. Jewish education will have to do a more comprehensive job. I believe there's simply no other choice. The same is true of mystical texts, of the Kabbalah. Once people have exposure to such texts, we may have no other choice but making sure that these texts are taught completely and properly. Thus, the original task of censorship, which is no longer practical, must be taken over by Jewish education, which must be more sophisticated than ever before. On some level, moving from censorship to education positions us to properly compete in the free marketplace of ideas. This marketplace of ideas that, like it or not, we are all a part of. From a religious point of view, this forces our hand towards a dor de'ah, a generation of greater knowledge that can ultimately pave the way for messianic times. Now, besides its topical nature, there's another reason that I chose to talk about the need to address censorship from a perspective that is in sync with changing realia. I see the issue as a symptom of a much greater problem. Even as I've hopefully approached this issue in a cogent and highly normative way, a halachic way, I do not expect my position to be articulated, much less to be accepted by our rabbinic leaders. Ironically, we are witnessing an ossification of halacha, dafka in a time characterized by the most dramatic and rapid changes in human history. I'm not, God forbid, claiming the existence of a malicious conspiracy. In some quarters, halachic conservatism comes from lack of exposure to modern society. In other quarters, from fear of the instability that would be caused by the rapid change in a halakha that would be engendered by appropriate assessment of contemporary realia. Yet, such leadership is willy-nilly making the untenable myth that halakha does not change into an unfortunate and unprecedented reality. While not malicious, this trend is pernicious. When we move away from the recognition of realia and its natural impact on halakha, we're not only moving away from reality, we are moving away from and ultimately denying truth itself. To use an example that we mentioned before, if Tosfot and other Rishonim are correct, that the level of kavanah, the level of concentration, is in fact not significantly different for a groom and for anyone else. For a groom to take the dispensation that we find in the Talmud that allows him not to say Kriyat Shema would put one in a position to believe that truth, that reality, has no impact on halakha, that there are fields divorced one from the other. I think you will agree that having Judaism on one side of the equation and truth on the other is a very dangerous situation indeed. In looking for recent models, one can look longingly at the Sri Deish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. In one of his very famous tshuvot, he deals with the issue of looking for leniencies in allowing mixed youth groups, and specifically allowing mixed singing within these youth groups. And by the way, I recommend that everyone read the entire tshuva. I believe you can find it in English as well, in Rabbi Ellenson's book. But in any case, it's a masterful analysis of contemporary culture from a religious perspective, and the need to address such a culture in halacha. Among other important observations, Reb Weinberg lauds the Torahim Derech Eretz approach that he found in Germany, which he laments was not present in Poland and Lithuania, as the rabbinic leadership there, and I quote, "Lo yad'u lechonen et hachinuch al pi tna'ei hazman." Since they did not know, the rabbinic leadership in Eastern Europe, says Rolf Weinberg, did not know how to organize Jewish education according to the conditions of the time. Not long ago, a debate appeared in the media, in the written media, over whether one could consider Rav Weinberg modern Orthodox or not. I think that such a debate misses the point. To check off Rabbi Weinberg on a scorecard that has the various positions that are identified with modern Orthodoxy is really not helpful. Rather, in placing Rabbi Weinberg as a model, I'm looking to someone who had the awareness and intellectual honesty to evaluate modernity's impact on halacha. Don't get me wrong. I'm not echoing the famous Orthodox feminist Blue Greenberg in her famous or infamous, if you like, words that when there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. I don't believe that to be true. I'm simply concerned about the lack of rabbinic will that exists at all to even entertain that halachic way. When I was first learning for Smicha here in Yerushalayim, I remember being invited to my first Talmud teacher, who had taught me many years before. And obviously I was quite proud of how much I had accomplished between the time I was in his class and the time that I was studying for Smicha. And as most of you in similar situations, you want to impress your old teacher. So I prepared very well. I took a very sophisticated Beit HaLevi on that week's Parsha, prepared it, and gave it over at his table. I was expecting to be commended for how much I'd been able to learn and grow and understand. Instead of that, however, the end of my Dvar Torah was greeted from my teacher with two words. So, what? He continued to explain that in his yeshiva, which was based on the Musar approach to Torah, one did not give a Dvar Torah, as he said was done in Brisk, that was merely an intellectual exercise. But rather, one gave a Dvar Torah that had to have some practical conclusions that would help someone in some way become a better person and Jew. So I echo my Rebbe's words and say, so what? So what practical conclusions can we gain as a result of tonight's analysis? The decisions to censor various scholars, works, or institutions probably does not affect many people in this room today. I remember that when Rav Shach was at his most militant, he inevitably censored the people that we felt were doing the most for Judaism. Rav Steinsaltz, Nechama Leibovitz, the Lubavitch Rebbe, and the list went on. In fact, it reached such Kafkaesque proportions that being censored seemed to be the best way to be certain that you were doing a good job as a Jewish leader. As such, for many of us in the audience, like myself, such bans do not have much credibility. If anything, when something gets banned, we immediately run to the bookstore to see if we can still get a copy. One conclusion that I will suggest is to realize that the entire halachic enterprise is threatened when we avoid reality and truth, as a result, I think we should show greater willingness to stand up for the truth. Many of us are far too indulgent of that which is false. For example, in my own neighborhood, it is common practice to distort information about a family's personal standards or orientation in order to get into certain schools, whose code is at odds with that of the home. In defense of such a practice, I heard of a parent declaring that when it comes to your children, you're willing to lie, cheat, or steal. I would like to make one thing clear. One cannot lie, cheat, or steal for one's children. One can only do such things against one's children. No matter how wonderful and spiritual a school environment may be, any resulting spiritual benefits are completely undermined by lying in order to get in. When we don't stand for that which is true, we often end up not standing for that which is morally correct either. Blurring distinctions between right and wrong is a very, very short step away. Got that wrong. Blurring distinctions between true and false is a very short step away from blurring distinctions between right and wrong. In a world more and more sophisticated, traditional Judaism can afford neither. Another practical conclusion has to do with a certain discussion that I had early on in the series. I think this conversation and its implications may provide us with an appropriate charge. Coming at the end of the series, such a charge would make the Judaism in Crisis series the type of watershed that we would like to see. This individual is a Rebbe at a Haredi yeshiva. He displayed great courage in coming to one of our lectures, informing me that his attendance in our presence threatened his continued employment at his yeshiva, if he were found out. He told me that our lectures were being heard by the wrong people. Recognizing that we are trying to engineer social change, he told me that you in the audience are not able to create that social change. He continued saying that leadership is in the hands of the Haredi yeshiva world, that they're the ones setting the tone of contemporary orthodoxy. He said this as a friend, in a friendly fashion, not meaning to attack you or us. Yet what was not meant as an attack, I think we should take it as an attack nonetheless, and an attack that we have to analyze in a sober fashion. If tonight's analysis suggests that Judaism is taking a course that is more and more divorced from acknowledgement of realia, as well as from that which is ultimately at the center of halakha, morality and spirituality, then we must all ask ourselves, what can I do about it? If our critic is correct, there is little we can do about it. And then we must further ask, why is it that the impact of my opinion and action is so limited? In other words, why are those of us who want to promote a more open and self-aware vision of orthodoxy not making a difference. The main attack against such a vision of orthodoxy is perhaps, as you know, that it doesn't work. It does not promote intensity of commitment. It does not promote high levels of observance. What it does do, so goes the common wisdom, is to allow for easier access to the paths of assimilation. These are very convincing arguments. And they've convinced many of our Orthodox brethren. These arguments are so convincing that in speaking recently with a major leader of modern Orthodoxy in the United States, he told me that he spends sleepless nights wondering if this is perhaps not true, if he is not actually promoting a vision that pushes most people away from commitment and not towards it. Herein is the challenge. If we really believe that Judaism is in crisis, we must do something. Early on in the series, I quoted from Rav Shimshon Fol Hirsch, comparing Judaism in his time to a house on fire. I don't think that fire was ever completely put out. In our generation, the house sometimes looks intact. In fact, we've even done shiputzim, added a floor or two. But upon more careful inspection, one realizes that there is a ferocious blaze destroying the foundation. Once that foundation is destroyed, the house will cave in. It will cave in before anyone can even realize what is going on. A leadership that allows and sometimes even promotes cultural ignorance, petty corruption, and intolerance cannot help us. We now have a choice. We can watch critically from the side, wave our fingers at our brethren, and smugly say, I told you so, as the house falls apart. Or we can try to push ourselves to religious levels that will command respect, allowing us to push aside a leadership that is failing. If the Lithuanian yeshiva community has been able to usurp the direction of orthodoxy, it is partly our fault. If we are not taken seriously, it is largely our fault. If we are to compete ideologically, we must also compete with their level of seriousness and commitment. We must also compete with their dedication to Torah study. As Rabbi Kupperman of Michalala once put it, we must be permeated by Torah and not punctuated by it. If Torah is not the raison d'etre of our existence, we'll be relegated to the position of helpless bystanders, even as our diagnosis of the contemporary crisis is correct. Friends, tonight we must throw our hats into the ring. When I say we, I'm not speaking only to tonight's audience, but everyone who will subsequently see the video, hear the audio, or look at the written notes. I'm actually speaking to all those who find common cause with our vision of an open, sophisticated, and intellectually honest brand of orthodoxy. For the sake of the Holy Torah, and for the sake of the future of the Jewish people, we must compete with our daily words, thoughts, and actions. We must show that an open orthodoxy can work. With every ounce of our strength, we must show that an open orthodoxy will work. I'm convinced that if we do this, the tide will change, and that we will in fact be able to set the tone. A tone that will not only be consistent with contemporary realia, but a tone that will be consistent with truth itself. Thank you.